Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on last month's district court decision in MetLife v. Financial Stability Oversight Council. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're happy to welcome our expert, Peter Wallison. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for his opening remarks of about 20 minutes, followed by your questions. Mr. Wallison, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Will. And welcome to all of you. I hope my voice is clear to you. I'm talking on my trusty iPhone from a hotel room in Dallas. So if you have any difficulty, I apologize for it. I thought it was probably best to start with a little introduction to why this case actually came about, because it has a lot to do with something called the Dodd-Frank Act, which many of you, or maybe all of you, might be familiar with. It was the Dodd-Frank Act actually was a response to a particular view of what caused the financial crisis. The idea was that the crisis occurred because of the failure of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. Lehman and other large firms were just not sufficiently regulated and took too many risks. That's probably the most broad-based description for why the Dodd-Frank Act was adopted. Therefore, future crises could be prevented, the sponsors thought, by more stringent regulation of these large firms. However, if I may introduce just one editorial comment here, I don't think the financial crisis was caused by the failure of Lehman or insufficient regulation, but actually by the buildup of subprime mortgages in the United States financial system. This affected both heavily regulated insured banks and lightly regulated organizations like Lehman, so regulation was not really a factor. Incidentally, if you are interested in how the crisis came about because of government housing policy, and the buildup of mortgages in the financial system, my book, Hidden in Plain Sight, can be found on Amazon. But to address the problem of insufficient regulation of large non-bank financial firms, the Dodd-Frank Act established something called the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which I'll call FSOC. FSOC is made up of the heads of all of the major financial regulators like the Fed, the SEC, the CFTC, the FDIC, and so forth. And it's chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. So this is a very powerful organization. And as I mentioned, it's the heads of all these agencies. It is not the agencies themselves. So all of them have been appointed by the administration that is now in office. So, and they are not actually asked to represent their agencies, but rather their own views. Now, the FSOC was authorized to designate firms as systemically important financial institutions, SIFI, SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions, if their, and these are the statutory words, if their, quote, material financial distress could, quote, pose a threat to U.S. financial stability, or if the nature, scope, size, scale, concentration, interconnectedness, or mix of activities of these firms could pose a threat also to U.S. financial stability. Now, this is an incredibly broad grant of discretionary authority. How can anyone, even an expert administrative agency, know whether at some point in the future financial distress of a particular company will cause instability in the financial system that exists at that future time. A legislature might be able to decide a question like this simply because it can be as arbitrary as it wishes, but can an administrative agency do it? And that's really the question that I think the court had to wrestle with here. In any event, a firm that the FSOC designates as a SIFI is turned over to the Fed for what the statute calls stringent regulation, and that's the statutory term, stringent regulation. Although the details of this regulation are unknown, the Fed has not fully outlined what this enhanced supervision will actually entail. These regulations, however, are likely to be extremely costly. In summary, the Act sponsors believe that another financial crisis can be prevented by giving the Fed the power to regulate firms that are a threat to stability, and the FSOC's task is to identify these firms. Thus far, since its establishment in 2010, FSOC has designated only four firms: GE Capital, AIG, the big insurance holding company, Prudential Insurance, and MetLife. But only MetLife sued. The others accepted their designation. However, GE Capital has recently announced that it is selling off its financial assets in the hope that it can be de-designated. But the FSOC has not indicated whether that will happen or what procedures will follow in order to allow GE Capital out. But the important point is that GE Capital is trying desperately to get out from under its designation. The FSOC has also taken an interest in threats to stability posed by the asset management industry, mutual funds, hedge funds, asset managers of all kinds. It has apparently decided that SIFI designations won't work for this industry, so it has been focusing on activities. In other words, instead of designating firms as SIFIs whose financial distress might cause instability, FSOC would focus on various products or activities that it believes could cause this instability. That goes back to that series of words I read earlier about mix of activities that might cause the same kind of financial instability as a firm designated as a SIFI. The MetLife case, I believe, also reflects the FSOC's authority to address authority to address activities, and I will get to that in just a little while. In December 2014, FSOC designated MetLife, and MetLife brought suit in April 2015. MetLife, who was represented incidentally in this case by Gene Scalia of Gibson Dunn, argued that FSOC had not produced any evidence that if MetLife encountered financial distress, that would cause instability in the U.S. financial system. Without evidence, he said, the FSOC was really authorized to make decisions that were essentially ipsa dixit, which is Latin for because I said so. In other words, just the ability to make statements, make decisions without any evidence. The government argued that because FSOC was made up of experts in financial regulation, all of these regulators are together at the FSOC, it could make this kind of judgment about the future based on MetLife's size and its interconnectedness with other firms. The court entered summary judgment for MetLife on several of MetLife's arguments. The most important one was that the FSOC had not actually made a reasoned prediction about the effect of MetLife's financial distress. It had not said what those losses would actually be, and how the market would actually destabilize if MetLife were actually to fail. The key language, I think, in the court's decision was, this court, and I'm quoting here, this court cannot affirm a finding that MetLife's distress would cause severe impairment of financial intermediation or financial market functioning when FSOC refused to undertake that analysis itself. The court suggested that if an agency is making a prediction like this, it is required by the Administrative Procedure Act to make a reasoned prediction. FSOC's decision, therefore, was arbitrary and capricious under the APA. This was not the only reason for the decision. The court also found that FSOC had not abided by the guidelines for SIFI designations that it had previously published. This was also considered arbitrary and capricious, but unique, I think, to this case. The court's decision also reflects the FSOC's ability to use the nature, scope, size, scale, concentration, interconnectedness, or mix of activities portion of its authority, as I mentioned earlier. These also involve deciding that one or more of these factors will cause instability in the future. The court's decision about reasoned decision-making, therefore, and reasoned predictions suggests that the FSOC must have more than just suppositions to support its case in, with these various activities issues about the future. Now, I think this decision is important for four specific reasons. First, it essentially puts the FSOC out of business until the case is overturned. So there will be no more SIFI designations and no potential restrictions on activities because they will cause, quote, instability in the U.S. financial system. Now, that's important. That probably means that through the end of the Obama administration, the FSOC will not be doing what it was authorized to do by this law that was adopted in 2010. Second, this ruling essentially places what is perhaps an insurmountable burden on the FSOC. You think about it, how can an agency demonstrate, other than through its expert opinion, that something as momentous as instability in the U.S. economy will occur in a future economy that is completely unknown and unknowable? What evidence could a court cite? Now, in many cases, what evidence can the agency cite? In many cases, as you know, agencies cite scientific evidence for taking positions that something will pollute or some other thing will happen because there's been an examination of these issues by scientists and they've come to some sort of reasoned conclusion, and the agency is willing to adopt that. But here we have a much different situation. We're talking about whether a firm like MetLife, if it fails at some time in the future or has financial distress sometime in the future, will affect that future economy, and you can't really know what that economy will look like at the time that occurs. So it's a very difficult hurdle for a future agency to overcome. The third point I think that's important about the case is that the court used the Administrative Procedure Act to overturn authority that had been unambiguously granted to the FSOC by Congress. Congress clearly gave the FSOC the authority to make this judgment. There's really no ambiguity about what the FSOC has been given in terms of power, but the court concluded that this does not overcome the need for reasoned decision making based on evidence. One might also almost say that instead of declaring the SIFI decision to be an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority, something that the courts really don't do anymore. The Supreme Court has not done that in many, many years, maybe since the 30s. The court simply found it inconsistent with the APA. So here's a way that the courts might avoid declaring something unconstitutional, which is a big step, but still have a resource for preventing administrative agencies from overstepping some of their powers. Fourth, in general, I think the case suggests that there is a limit to the discretion that can be employed by regulatory agencies. They must engage in reasoned decision-making, which includes evidentiary support, and thus creates kind of a limit on the growth in the future of the administrative state. Still, a lot of caution is warranted. This is only a federal district court case. The case will probably go to the Supreme Court. I think it's important enough in terms of what constraints it puts on administrative agencies to go to the court, and I think the Treasury Department's pressure will, in any event, probably cause the Justice Department to go ahead with an appeal, even if they lose, or certainly if they lose at the appeals court level. Also, this is not a rulemaking case. It's a case where the agency made a quasi-judicial decision, a fact-finding involving an individual firm. So its application to rulemaking is not as clear. And it is not, strictly speaking, a Chevron deference case, which involves deference for an agency when it interprets its own statute. However, there are deference elements here because the government said at trial that the FSOC deserved deference because of its expertise, and frequently courts, when they talk about deference, pull in the importance of the court, of the administrative agency's expertise in defining the scope of its own authority. One other major effect, and I think I have a few minutes left that I'd like to talk about, is that it will probably end for the rest of the Obama administration any action by the Financial Stability Board in Europe to create a foundation for subjecting shadow banking to prudential regulation. The Treasury and the Fed are members of the FSB, that is the Financial Stability Board, and both have expressed strong interest in subjecting these so-called shadow banks, which would include, say, broker-dealers, asset managers, hedge funds, insurance companies, pension funds, finance companies of all kinds, to prudential regulation, just like banks. The FSB has spent years developing a theory that would capture shadow banks and finally came up with one. They say that a complex chain of transactions that results in maturity transformation, that is changing, for example, a short-term deposit into a long-term loan, is a maturity transformation, and it's very risky, and it is done by banks. But they suggest that in a chain of transactions involving a number of these so-called shadow banks, you could create the same kind of maturity transformation, and that would mean that these institutions, which are generally not regulated, these so-called shadow banks, should be subject to some kind of prudential regulation. But the FSB cannot act, the Financial Stability Board, really in practical terms, cannot act without the U.S., because putting these restrictions on all these firms in Europe or elsewhere and not putting them on U.S. firms would give U.S. firms a tremendous advantage. So unless the FSOC can start covering activities, as I indicated it would have trouble doing under this case, it would be difficult for the FSB to do anything without the legal foundation that the FSOC needs in the United States. So any of such decisions by the FSB are going to have to also await the outcome of the MetLife case. So that's where I am in 20 minutes, and I'd Love to take your questions. Thanks.
All right, thank you. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. Okay, again, if you want to ask a question, please hit star and the pound key. Our line is wide open right now. While we wait to see if anybody has a question, which, again, please hit star and pound to ask that question, I want to make a quick programming announcement. Our next Teleforum call is going to take place tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. We'll be recapping and analyzing the oral arguments in Robert F. McDonald v. United States, which is being heard tomorrow morning. We hope that many of you will join us for that call. We still don't have any questions here. We've got a big audience, though. Please hit star and then pound. And it looks like we do have one on the line now. So we're going to go to this question, and if you would like to be the second questioner, please at any point hit star and the pound key.
Hey, Peter. Tony Cotto with the NAIC. As I'm sure you know, the state regulator, who is the primary regulator in this case, wrote a dissenting opinion on the designation. Any thoughts that you may have given to sort of a scenario in which the solution could be more deference to primary regulators to avoid these problems in the future?
Interesting. Very interesting question, Tony. And just for the audience, NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and there is an expert in insurance among the 10 members of the 10 voting members of the FSOC. That one insurance expert dissented from the designation of MetLife, as he has dissented from the designation. He also dissented from the designation of Prudential. So that is significant in one sense. It might also be significant to the courts. It was mentioned certainly in the brief by MetLife, because what it suggests is that the FSOC, which is made up of federal financial regulators who know nothing about insurance, have taken some major steps here in attempting to cover an insurance company. Now, to the question about whether it will have some effect for the NAIC and insurance regulators in general, yes, I think the result is, if this goes to the Supreme Court and if the Supreme Court upholds the position that was taken by the court in this case, it will free many insurance companies from potential designation by the FSOC over time. It's very difficult, as I suggested in my testimony, in my talk, it's very difficult to imagine how any agency can predict what will happen to the economy of the United States, the financial system of the United States, at some unknown time in the future if something is designated as an insurance, as a SIFI. So I think what this means is that it could potentially take away the possibility that the Fed will begin to have authority to regulate the largest insurance companies because they have been designated as SIFIs. And that would turn it back to state regulation solely without any federal regulation.
All right, we don't have any questions on the line right now. I hope that you will hit star and the pound key to get in queue, and we'll put you on as soon as you do that. While we wait to see if anybody wants to weigh in by hitting star and pound. Oh, well, hold on. We do have another one here, and I don't want to steal their question, so let's go to that next caller. After this caller, our lines will be open, so please, once again, star and then pound to ask your question.
Hi, this is Joanne Madero. Peter, I'm curious why you think the FSOC loss in MetLife constrains the FSB.
Because
they don't seem to follow any rule of law.
Right. But my reasoning is as follows. The FSB isn't following any rule of law. I agree with that. They've never suggested what legal constraints there are on them, but they have themselves designated the same three U.S. firms as global SIFIs, the same three insurance companies, AIG, MetLife, and Prudential, as insurance companies. But what they are really after, and what I was talking about near the end of my discussion, is the shadow banking system. They want to, this is the FSB, wants to subject to prudential regulation these broker-dealers and asset managers who are not subject today to prudential regulation of any kind. Now, as a practical matter, they cannot do this unless the U.S. does it too. Now, the U.S. is a member of the Financial Stability Board. The Fed and the Treasury and the SEC are members, and they have approved everything that the Financial Stability Board has done up to this time. But for the things that the Financial Stability Board wants to accomplish in the United worldwide, not just for Europe, they have to have the same rules imposed in the United States, and it would be very difficult to find authority to do that other than the FSOX authority to designate SIFIs or to designate firms under their activities authority, because it will cause instability in the future. If the FSOC can't do that, then it seems to me the FSB is stymied, is at a halt, because they don't want to impose those restrictions only in Europe or in Japan, which is also a member, and China, which is also a member of the FSB, without having the U.S. on board, because that would just leave U.S. firms in a position to compete much more effectively without prudential regulation.
So are you saying is because the FSB, but the FSB could still name firms as G-SIFIs, but they have no direct power to impose consequences?
Well, operating in Europe or in the countries that are members of the FSB.
No, in the U.S. In the U.S., they don't.
Well,
they would need national authorities.
Right. What I was going to say is simply that they can do it through the internal jurisdictions in Europe and Japan and China and so forth, but they don't have authority in the United States. The only authority in the United States is the FSOC. And it looked for a while as though the FSOC might actually have the power to impose some kinds of restrictions that are correlative with the restrictions that the FSB has in mind.
Thanks.
Okay, we did pick up two additional questioners while we answered that question. If you want to join the queue after these two, please hit star and then pound. We'll go to the next caller now.
Hi, this is Rod Sullivan in Jacksonville. All of these things, enhanced supervision, enhanced prudential controls, all sound relatively innocuous. In real life, when the federal government steps in and provides enhanced supervision, what does that mean?
Well, we don't actually know the full extent of it right now because the Fed hasn't actually outlined it in full. But here's what the law says, and this is, I'm talking here about a section of the Dodd-Frank Act. It defines these enhanced supervision standards as, at a minimum, this is not only what the Fed might do, but at a minimum, you have to have risk-based capital requirements and leverage limits, liquidity requirements of various kinds, overall risk management requirements, resolution plan and credit exposure report requirements, and concentration limits. Now, those are the minimums that the statute is imposing, and that would it then would require the Fed, if the Fed is the regulator in this case, and it would be for any firm that is designated as a SIFI or comes under the activities rules of the FSOC, the Fed would, as a minimum, have to impose those kinds of restrictions, which are not normal restrictions for firms that are not subject to prudential regulation right now. And then on top of that, the Fed would probably impose many others also that it thinks are needful in a situation like this.
You know, it just seems, maybe it's just me, but it seems to me like the federal government coming in and analyzing financial risk for a company whose business is analyzing financial risk and assigning premiums based upon that seems sort of counterproductive. We sort of have an amateur, you know, telling a professional how to run their risk-assessed business. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, but I don't think you're wrong, of course, but the Dodd-Frank Act thinks you're wrong. That was passed by Congress in 2010 as a result of the financial crisis. If you believe the financial crisis was actually caused by lack of regulation of the private financial system, which is, of course, what the Congress said at the time and what the Dodd-Frank Act is based on, then all this makes sense to you. But if you believe that there were other causes of the financial crisis, and as I mentioned, I believe it was caused by government housing policy, then all of this is unnecessary.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
All right, we still have two questions on the line. We'll go to the next one now. If you'd like to join the queue, please do by hitting star and the pound key.
This is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. Thank you very much for your talk today. I have two questions for you. The first is a little more theoretical than the second. First, I was wondering if you could comment on what significance this decision might have on the idea of regulation by uncertainty, which we see a little bit of. The idea being that if you can impose an uncertain regulation, you not only get the benefit of what's clearly covered by the regulation, but you also get the benefit of what people subjectively think might be covered by the regulation. So you have sort of an interim effect. I'm wondering if this opinion might have some instruction on the validity or the scope of that idea. A second and a much more concrete level, if this went to the Supreme Court and Secretary Clinton is President of the United States, it seems to me that the court would have only four identifiable righties, which would leave what would happen with this case in the hands of either Justice Breyer or Justice Kagan. I suspect that Justice Breyer, given his tolerance for a lot of administrative solutions, probably would be open-minded to the Dodd-Frank framework. And so I guess it all comes down, and you might say, to Justice Kagan and whether she would be disinclined to see the merits of this or not. So I would appreciate it if you could give me your impression on those two questions.
Okay, thank you. I am not a sufficiently informed Supreme Court follower to be able to parse Justice Kagan's views on questions like this, so I'll have to leave that one open. But the first question is a really interesting one, regulation by uncertainty, because I've written a lot on the subject of what powers the FSOC might have but hasn't yet exercised. And one of those powers, I have thought, is the power to say certain kinds of activities are troubling to us. And if you are engaged in those activities, then you should be subject to regulation by the Federal Reserve. Now, they haven't actually, in that case, declared anyone to be a SIFI or to be subject to their power of regulation on the basis of activities, but they have warned people that businesses that if they engage in certain kinds of activities, they're either going to have to get the approval of the FSOC or the Fed, or they run the risk of being designated. So That's regulation by uncertainty, certainly, and it could be very powerful. That's another one of the reasons why I think that this case is so important.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
Okay, we have one more question on the line. We'll go to that question now. After that question, we will take you immediately if you hit star and the pound key at any point.
Hi, this is Jim Doyle. I'm an attorney in Maryland. And my question really relates to whether this theory in this federal court opinion could be applied to other areas of the law, completely different areas out of, you know, financial regulation. And let me pose this kind of a situation to you. And I understand this was a federal case, but let's say that this theory would gain some acceptance. We go to the Supreme Court, and that it would then be used perhaps in state court challenges. Maryland has created, through its legislature, a commission to study climate change on the environment and to make recommendations to the Maryland Department of the Environment regarding climate change. And it specifically in the legislation has set out a goal, a percentage reduction of greenhouse gases that it wants met by 2030. And the commission is supposed to look into what measures can be taken to meet that goal. And that includes a whole broad range of things throughout the economy. But this legislation also says that the commission is also to consider the effect on jobs and economic activity in the state for the purpose of increasing economic business and activity in the state. When I look at this and listen to, and I have not read the opinion in the MetLife case, but just listening to the conversation, when you talk about something being speculative and difficult to ascertain down the line, it seems to me that some of these things, for example, climate change and what occurs within the state a decade and a half down the line, both in terms of the climate change itself and in terms of what happens to the economy, is extremely difficult and speculative. So my question really is, and I don't know if you've given this any thought, but my question is whether or not you think this theory, if it holds up, would at some point apply to these other types of areas?
Well, I mentioned this a little bit in my opening remarks because I do think where you're talking about what is essentially scientific evidence that is relied on by scientists, and for which scientists can show that a predicted outcome is likely to occur on the basis of some data, then I think it's not covered by this kind of case. The unique thing about this case is that we are talking about two things. One is the failure of, or instability of, a firm like MetLife at some time in the future. So there are two things that have to be known. One is, okay, what happens when MetLife fails? And then what is the financial system of the future? What does it look like? I mean, how would anyone know whether a MetLife failing at that time? You don't know this, how big MetLife will be, how interconnected, so-called, it will be, how its failure will affect other firms, and you don't know what the financial system of the future will look like either. So it's far different from the kind of thing that a court might confront when you look at this climate change issue. Now, I'm no fan of the climate change. Those who support climate change and actions that should be taken now to to prevent climate change, but I do think that a court confronted with this case would be given an awful lot of data by climate change advocates, for example, who would say that there's plenty of data that tells us what will happen to the economy, what will happen to the financial system, what will happen to the climate, what will happen to the weather, what will happen to water supplies and all the rest of those things if we do not restrict the growth in carbon dioxide production. So I think the two are really different. The thing about this case that is so unusual is the fact that the unknowns are unknowable, whereas in the case of climate change, if we focus on that alone, the unknowns are debatable, but they are not unknowable. And so I would distinguish the two cases, and I'd say that even if this case goes to the Supreme Court, and even if the court upholds the district court decision ultimately, it would not have an impact on what you're talking about in Maryland.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We don't have any questions on our line now. We'll consider this to be the last call for questions. Please hit star and pound if you have a question. We do have one more question here. And this doesn't necessarily have to be the last question. So if you also have a question, please do hit star and pound. And we will go to you next.
Hello, Peter. Wayne Abernathy here with American Bankers Association. Really appreciate the information you've been providing here. Very insightful and helpful. I've kind of a fundamental question I want to put to you, and it really gets at this whole question of designating institutions as SIFIs. I'm hard-pressed to find examples other than Fannie and Freddie where we've had genuine SIFIs here in the United States, that is, institutions that in and of themselves presented a risk that brought down the financial system. That certainly wasn't the case with Lehman. It was the case with Fannie and Freddie in terms of their impact, but that's because there was strong government support pushing concentrating a lot of financial instruments into Fannie and Freddie. And so I just really wonder this fixation that Dodd-Frank has on wanting to identify this and that and all these other institutions as being SIFIs seems to me a lot of effort wasted on things that are really beside the point.
Yeah, I agree completely with you, Wayne. Thank you for the question. I'd like to point out to you and other people who might still be listening is that this whole idea that the failure of a large non-bank financial institution will cause a financial crisis is false. We seldom have in social sciences evidence of something being wrong, and in this case we do, because Lehman Brothers, which was a very large financial institution, $650 billion, failed. And although there was chaos, the chaos came from the fact that the government had first created the impression that it was going to rescue these large firms when it rescued Bear Stearns, and then it reversed its policy at the last minute and didn't rescue Lehman Brothers. That created the chaos, but no other financial institution failed as a result of Lehman's failure. So we do know that this business of interconnections between large financial institutions, that was one of the reasons for trying to get control, regulatory control of all these non-bank financial institutions, is bogus. So Fannie and Freddie, you're perfectly right about Fannie and Freddie. It's not that their failure would have caused any kind of financial breakdown. The reason Fannie and Freddie were rescued is that they had come to dominate the housing finance system in the United States that if they actually went out of business, there wouldn't be a housing finance system in the United States. So right. They had to be rescued for that reason. But I think fundamentally, your idea is correct. Non-bank financial institutions in general should be left alone. They are better regulated by market discipline than they are by the government. and the record of the government is on regulation is poor, because if you look at regulation, if you look at what happened in the financial crisis, heavily regulated banks and lightly regulated non-banks all had trouble because of the problems in the mortgage business. It had nothing to do with whether they were heavily regulated or lightly regulated.
Thank you. Very helpful. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Okay, so this is the real last call for questions now. Please hit star and the pound key very quickly if you have one more question. And seeing none, Mr. Wallison, do you want to make a closing remark before we adjourn?
No, I do want to thank the Federalist Society, just this, that these are wonderful opportunities for those of us who have views on this subject or any subject, and to talk to some people who are obviously very well versed and have an interest in these questions. So Federalist Society is doing some wonderful things here, and I want to thank all the people who listened in and asked questions for doing so.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for squeezing us into your busy travel schedule. Thanks, everyone, for dialing in. We hope to hear from a lot of you tomorrow at 1 when we'll be discussing the Supreme Court oral argument in former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald's appeal of his corruption conviction. But until that call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.